women's literature and, you know, frequently, you know, teach Octavia Butler's works. And I always like to give my students a certain kind of scaffolding before we get into talking about a text or an author. And so, you know, I'd be reading interviews or, you know, articles about her. I've written a couple of articles about her, academic ones. And I just wanted to know more. I'm nosy. I'm a researcher. So he's like, right. Okay, so how did you come to this conclusion, or why did you do this? And Butler was a pretty private person, right? Mm-hmm. When she passed, you know, she left behind this voluminous archive, and I wanted to get in there and learn more about her intellectual process. So that's what prompted me to write this book.
But it's a biography, you know, I mean, yeah. I can see you writing, you know, doing academic articles, you know, placing essays, but the biography seems like it's like, you know, all of a sudden you're a long distance runner.
Yes. And I'm not a historian. Oftentimes, biographers are historians. They're folks who are writing histories of places or people. And I'm a literary critic. I'm like, this is what this metaphor means. Right. Simile means, this is the imagery. And so I was most interested in her intellectual process. I wanted to know what books she read, why she read them, when she read them, how did she take her notes, who were the folks that she spoke with, what was her writing practice like? Those are the sort of questions that fueled me in many ways. Yeah.
You know, I've noticed some interesting things on the part of this new generation of biographers of African-American women. They seem, and I'll use you as an example, you seem that it's writing about a woman's life, but you're involved. You've started also writing about yourself in terms of what does this woman mean to me? And mm-hmm. So the biography is at times very personal. All of a sudden the I comes in there. You know, this is yeah. What I feel like. And talk about that. Is that something that you see? I talked with Alex Gums and she had Audre Lorde, and I found that happening, you know. Looking at Imani Perry, you know, I'm just looking at this list of wonderful mm-hmm. critics who yeah. now doing the heavy lifting, but yeah. at the same time placing themselves where it says, okay, there's a spiritual relationship between you and Octavia Butler.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely like a kind of sense of kindred spirits of sorts, you know, not necessarily in the way, I mean, Alexis and I are friends and we've talked about our work and, you know, she would be talking about communing with Audre Lorde, and I'm like, I'm not communing with Octavia. That's not the kind of ancestor that she is. she's telling me to write, to get my butt in the seat and write, to get to the archive and look at the papers, you know. But I do think, like, all the folks that you mentioned, you know, Imani Perry and Alexis Pauline Gums and myself and others, I'm thinking like Tanisha Ford or Ashley Farmer.
And Valerie Boyd, who's deceased. But
rest in peace. You know, many of these folks we identify as Black feminist scholars. Mm-hmm. And a core tenet of Black feminism, of feminism more generally, is that the personal is political, right? So I say in the beginning of the book of Positive Obsession that this is one way to tell Octavia's story. There are many ways to tell it. This is how I'm choosing to tell it. And because I, you know, start the book with this experience I had when I was a young person in high school of first discovering her work and how it just changed the trajectory of my life. And mm-hmm. I could not write this book without telling that story. So it's not that I'm in like every page or every chapter right. even necessarily. There are key moments where I'm like, okay, let me break the fourth wall and say, I'm here and I experienced this thing. So like in my chapter on the parable series, I sort of talk about it, situate myself politically and, you know, where I've been teaching this book. I've taught at many institutions and sort of my experience teaching the series and so on. So, yeah, a biographer doesn't necessarily have to do that, but I do think there's a particular kind of efficacy in being like, hey, I'm a person taking a neutral stance. I don't believe in neutrality. This is my particular perspective in engaging her life.
Well, you know, there's a point in your book that made me laugh. You said, Octavia Butler encouraged writers to run away from home or to travel. And I said, I could see Susanna Morris with her Kamala sneaks running away from home.
I'm there. Look, I'm more of an Adidas girl, but yes, you know, I'm there running away, maybe like how people used to have the hobo sticks where you have the stick with a kerchief at the end. Yeah. Like, no.
Well, let's talk about that. Did you feel that you needed to maybe go to some sort of retreat or something like that just to get away from and have that space?
I didn't have a retreat per se, but I was lucky enough to have two fellowships that helped to support the writing, because you know, I started working on this book in 2020, right before the pandemic started. And for a good chunk of it, I was writing this book from my house. I wasn't going on campus. I'm a caregiver for my mom. And so, you know, she is immunocompromised. I have my own health challenges. So we were keeping it very locked down. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, as the world started opening up, I was able to work for a semester at Princeton University as an Anschutz fellow. And I taught a class, a Butler seminar, and I just had a lot of latitude and leeway to, you know, work on my my writing. And then I also spent a semester at the University of Michigan in their Humanities Center. And I didn't teach any classes. All I did every week was work with other folks. So they were professors of all ranks, and also folks, graduate students who were working on their dissertations. And every week somebody would offer up a piece of their manuscript and we would read and critique one another's work. And that was really helpful as well. So the combination of like students, like I'm working with these students and they're so sharp and incisive. And then the next semester being around all these folks who are at different points in their career. Some people are like, I've been a professor for 50 years. I'm like, okay. And then other folks are like, I'm in my 20s and I'm trying to figure out how to write this dissertation. And everyone had something of value to share. Mm-hmm. And so those were some of the places where I was able to really zero in. But there were no like retreats per se.
Right.
Although I'm not against that. I just did not experience that.
Right. Well, you know, you mentioned something in your book, which is very, very important. And it places Octavia Butler alongside her sister writers. You talk about Toni Cabin Barrow, Audre Lorde, June Jordan, others, how these women have to balance, you know, their lives, sometimes raising the children by themselves, or in terms of Octavia Butler, you know, she had health issues. Talk about that.
Yeah. So throughout her life, you know, Octavia experienced a variety of health issues, from, you know, dental issues to heart issues, you know, high blood pressure. She certainly suffered from depression at different points in her life. You know, she talked about that. So part of what this book attempts to do is to pull back the veil and you know, I don't really believe in putting writers on pedestals, because the only way that you have to go is down from a pedestal, mm-hmm. right? So really, you know, just highlighting the very mundane, regular human experiences that Octavia had, though she was a genius, to be clear. I'm mm-hmm. not arguing that she wasn't, but she was a genius that often didn't have health insurance. Mm-hmm. And so she was committed to writing these stories, you know, doing this research, but sometimes her body hurt because she spent years doing physical labor, you know, doing manual jobs. Towards the end of her life, when she was also suffering from a type of writer's block, she was dealing with high blood pressure and taking kind of a cocktail of medicines. And one medicine, and if you're on medicines, you know that this may be your experience, you take one thing and it causes a side effect.
So right, you get drowsy, thing. Right, you get sleepy.
Right. Right, exactly. So that was happening. I feel drowsy, or I'm having insomnia, or I have this incessant cough. Like, what's going on? Every time I try to rest, I'm, you know, so she just had these experiences that really affected her experience as a writer. There was no like, I'm going to a room of my own with a lock and a key, and I have like, you know, people taking care of my stuff. She had to do it herself, and it was often very difficult.
How much of what you just said feeds into Octavia Butler's development of her character? So does her characters carry some of these semblances because of what she's going through personally?
Yeah. So I think, you know, there are many examples, but one I think that listeners will be perhaps most familiar with is in Kindred. So like Octavia, Dana worked as in temp jobs while she was pursuing her writing. And this is what Butler did in the beginning of her career. She would often also just have her characters kind of look like her, right? They wouldn't literally be her, but there's a number of characters who are kind of of tall, full-bodied, sometimes short natural hair, you know, at some point in the journey. So, you know, characters that kind of look like this, Dana, Lauren Olamina, Alana from Survivor to a certain degree, though she's described as a mixed race woman. Like, there are these like kind of tall, regal, full-bodied, dark-skinned Black women who sometimes have experienced the, like, okay, a similar job or maybe a similar family experience, right? So Lauren is from a pretty similar area than, you know, Octavia's from, right? She sets up many of her stories in Southern California, right? Or what was formerly Southern California, depending on the time period. So there is a lot of connection there.
Talk about you sort of alluded to it because of color. You know, you're dealing with an African-American woman who's tall, who's dark complexion. How much is that affecting, you know, her life?
Oh, it affected her life a lot. So Octavia was about 6 feet tall by the time she was in middle school, right? So, I mean, I recall being a tall girl. I'm 5'7". I'm not 6 feet tall, but being taller than all the boys and most of the girls and so on. But I was not 6 feet tall. So 6 feet tall is very tall, right? She talks about when she was, you know, a young girl, middle school, high school, going out with some of her friends, her girlfriends, and they, you know, someone in out in the public would be like, oh, is this your mother? Referring to her, right? Which was extremely embarrassing and also, you know, reflects the ways in which Black girls are often adultified. She didn't look like nobody's mother. You look at the pictures of her as a youth, it's like, this is a tall young person, you know. Or the ways in which Black women, particularly dark-skinned Black women, can be masculinized, even when they themselves are not sort of saying, I'm embodying a type of masculinity, right? Because anybody can be masculine. It doesn't belong to a certain gender. But sometimes it's foisted on us in a particular kind of way. I'm thinking about the Serena Williams, you know, particularly when she started playing tennis and all of that. So,
you know, I'm glad you said this because I won't mention the publication. But I was many years ago, I was an advisor to a publication. And we're sitting around the talking about who's going to be on the cover of whatever. And they're talking, oh, we're going to stick Maya Angelou on the cover because, you know, people have recognition. And I said, no, let's put Octavia Butler on the cover of the magazine, dark-skinned woman, you know. And the reason why I said that is because I remember when Essence magazine, the magazine for today's Black women, came out, and it took years for them to put a dark-skinned woman with a gap between her teeth on the front of the magazine because they had these concepts of beauty that were projected onto the Black community.
Yes. And so she experienced that. She was born in 1947. She was a baby boomer. And yeah, she came of age during the, like, I'm Black and I'm Proud kind of era, Black power, civil rights movement, and so on. But as you mentioned, there are these deeply embedded, internalized aspects of white supremacy that we often have to decolonize our minds, you know, to get rid of. And so she for sure experienced that. You know, she talked about as a young person that kind of curtailing some of her dating and social aspects, like the way she looked. And then that matched with she was extremely shy and very introverted. And there are oftentimes these stereotypes about how Black women act, like we're always sassy, we have an attitude, angry Black woman, that kind of thing. And she was a person with a full range of personality like any other Black woman or person. But she was definitely not falling into whatever perceived notions of Black womanhood and sexuality.
You know, in writing your biography, Susanna Mars, you went through a lot of correspondence and notebooks and journals by Octavia Butler. Were the things in Butler's notebook that surprised you?
I think what was perhaps most surprising was how hard she was on herself. That was hard to read as a fan and a biographer. She was really exacting about her work. Which makes sense. She literally had a positive obsession. But, you know, she would have in her journals, she had journals for travel, journals for, you know. And in those journals, she would have lots of different things in one book. So she might have a shopping list, a budget, entry from the day, and then maybe a sample of writing. And the writing would be amazing. Right.
How organized are her archives?
Very organized.
And where's the location?
They're at the Huntington Library in San Marino, California. And it is a public library. You do have to apply, get a card, and you have to go through a process to be able to see the stuff, but you don't have to be a professor.
Is anything restricted by Octavia Butler?
There are some, I think maybe 4 or 5 boxes that are embargoed for the next couple of decades, right? I think maybe the earliest one, if I'm correct, is embargoed until 2047, and then there are ones that are embargoed.
Do you, as a detective biographer, wonder what's in those boxes or have an idea?
I don't know what's in them, but I suspect what I know about archives is that oftentimes when people embargo things, it's because there is maybe material in there that could be inflammatory or perhaps embarrassing to folks who are still alive, right? So hopefully by 2047, don't nobody care. Or by 2057, it's like, I've gone to the great beyond. Who cares? You know, so I just presume it because that is generally the case. That is maybe some secrets or, you know, who knows? Octavia did not live a particularly scandalous life. She lived a life of the mind. You know, she was close to her family. She had a good, you know, cadre of friends and so on. But everybody has their stuff that maybe they don't want people to know about in the same way. I mean, she voluntarily offered up her archive. I mean, she was asked by the Huntington and she agreed, right? And she gave them everything, but with particular caveats, which is very common.
So we pick up your book and we know that you're introduced to Octavia Butler when you're in high school, you know, and that's on that. Did you discuss her work with some schoolmates and stuff like that? You know, we like a little book club going on of people who've been back in the room reading science fiction.
Yeah, no, I didn't. I read my science fiction and fantasy alone. People
knew, I like how you say that, alone.
People thought it was weird. Like, why are you reading? This was like before, you know, Harry Potter, as problematic as the series is. It was before, you know, all Twilight and sort of the mainstreaming in some ways, the Hunger Games, all that kind of stuff. And so I was a teenager in the 1990s and kind of a girl from Fort Lauderdale like myself reading these thick science fiction and fantasy books with elves and whatever on the front. Folks were like, that girl's nice, but she's weird. So no, I did not talk about it with my friend, but they could see I was doing it, you know, right. It wasn't until I got older and got to college and beyond, it was like I found other people that were also into the stuff.
Well, you know, you had a very nice review in the New York Times October 5th by Dana Williams, who just put out a new book on Tony at Random, which is very good. Mm-hmm. In that review, Dana talks about you interviewed a number of people, and I was wondering how those interviews went. Who did you want to interview that you didn't receive an interview with? And then also, what has happened to me if you recorded those interviews? Where are you depositing those interviews?
Oh, that's a good question. I recorded them, you know, over Teams. They're on my computer. They're in the cloud. No one has asked me anything about saving them, but they are saved. I mostly talk to writers who knew her, or writers who are connected to, like, her work today. So, for example, I interviewed both adapters for the graphic novel series. So I spoke to John Jennings, who's the illustrator for, you know, all 3 books, and just talked about his experience working on it, why he made particular choices that he did, and so on. You know, I spoke with Cherie Renee Thomas, who's such a significant writer and editor, you know, who edited
Dark Matter,
yeah, both volumes, and, you know, worked with Octavia and so on. So those were the people that
did
I
really did with the married couple, Barnes
and Reeve do, yeah, and yeah. Stephen Barnes. I did not talk with them, but I spoke with many folks, and I really got to talk to everyone that, for the most part, I mean, some people were busy. It was the pandemic. There were lots of things, but I also just, there's so much material in the archive.
Let me ask you this question in terms of, it has a lot to do with I call it the big band of scholars and critics. Do you, did you look at critical articles? Has there been a lot of critical articles about Octavia Butler, like, say, in Calhoun magazine or some journals overseas? I mean, does she have this international presence?
There's absolutely mostly American, but certainly international criticism for sure. And that's really where I started because I am a professional scholar
right.
and I have published two for sure, articles on Butler over the years, and also recently last year co-edited a special issue of the Black Scholar with my colleague Michelle Wright, and really focusing on emerging scholars. And so they wrote about Octavia and Nnedi Okorafor and different folks. So there's a I would say cottage industry, as there is about many Black women writers who emerge from this kind of 1970s literary renaissance. So I started out as a Morrisonian. So I'm so excited about Dana's book and all the love that it's received, because it's a really wonderful text and very necessary, So
if I was a young African-American woman and I'm down at the Georgia Institute of Technology and you're my mentor, I'm interested in Octavia Butler. Are there things that you would say, look, I did this biography, but there's a lot of material on Octavia Butler that needs to be examined. What would you recommend some of the things that a young scholar of interest in Octavia Butler should pursue?
Oh, there's so many different things. I think in terms of biographies, I would love to read a biography that is about her travels, because she wrote about her travels so explicitly and meticulously throughout her journals. If there's someone, and I had a young person in my last Butler seminar that I taught last spring, she was a biology major, and she wanted to look at how Butler talked about plants. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of discussion both in the works but also across her archive where she's noting, this is what's in bloom in my neighborhood during
that. That sounds like Alexis Gum dealing with Audre Lorde. Is this all of a sudden, yeah, like, where African-American women were throwing rocks, women were analyzing the rocks.
I mean, we're really talking about polymaths here who are just well-versed in so many different things. And so Octavia was interested in sociobiology, anthropology. She was interested in biology, botany.
What's the challenge for you now as a biographer? Do you have to pursue all of those, at least have a knowledge? You're writing a biography of this person, and this person has all these different interests. Do you say, okay, let me spread my map and make sure I go down these roads to make sure that when I put my biography together, it does talk about her interest in botany, it does interest in her travel?
I mean, to a certain degree, but I think as a writer, you have to make a choice. Mm-hmm. What is my perspective? What am I really focusing on? Because again, there could be so many different biographies or critical assessments of her work. And there already are many, many, many critical assessments of her work. But I decided I'm looking at the intellectual trajectory. I'm looking at how she researched things. So I mentioned, yes, she's noting these things. She's taking notes, and I kind of leave it there, and the next person can pick that up.
Right. Well, I'm going to go back to something you said, and I want to bring in another person who's deceased, but very important. I remember when I used to talk to Claudia Tate a lot, and she had a book that came out in 1985, Black Women Writers at Work, with these interviews. But she also said that if you're a scholar, you can't just say, because somebody said something in the interview, you got to take it as face value, because sometimes people, they lie when they
stress the truth. Or misremember.
Or misremember. And did you find that, after reviewing, interviewing people, and based on your own research, you say, well, this is not actually right, or I think they have a misunderstanding of Octavia Butler?
I didn't really necessarily encounter misunderstandings. I think that she has, even though there have been any number of critical assessments, and there has been a middle grades biography, there's been a literary biography of her, there's an artist companion that Lionel George did, there's works on her, but there's still not enough, right? So we're still excavating. A thing that I thought was interesting is that in many scholarly works, I see people talking about 1976, as the year that she went off and went to D.C. and or the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and was preparing for Kindred, and she was working on Kindred in 1976, but she took that trip in 1977. That's a minor detail, but I thought that was interesting. She did take a trip in 1976, and it was across the United States on a Greyhound, going from city to city, because she had not really traveled outside of going to the Clarion workshop in Pennsylvania. So that was important to her, that she was able to travel alone, right, as a person who didn't have a whole lot of money. And then the next year she went on another travel, right? Yeah, so that was something that I thought, people don't know that. Right. They don't have that. You have to get into the archive.
Right. In doing your book, Positive Obsession, did you do a lot of traveling with certain collections? You say, I've got to go to Schoenberg. I got to go to places like that, you know, Moreland Spinn, Garden Howard. Did you have to?
Yeah, I went to a few places, but mostly her stuff is in the Huntington. Mm-hmm. And then when I these days, you can get almost anything online. So, you know, there was like one piece from the Schoenberg. I'm like, okay, I can request that, you know, so you don't actually, although I love going to the Schoenberg, but you don't necessarily have to be there. So that has democratized research in really important ways.
Yeah. You know, when you say that, I'm always concerned about, I'm looking at historically black colleges. Sometimes, you know, we lag behind in terms of digitalizing things. We have the material, but unless you actually come in, you know, you can't
see. Yeah. Yeah, and I experienced that too. So I went to look at Tony Cade Bambara's archive because they were friends, Tony mm-hmm. Cade and Octavia Butler. And I live in Atlanta, so I hopped right on over to Spelman, where I taught for a very brief period in the early 2000s. And I went over and spoke with the wonderful archivist, Holly Smith, and, you know, was able to get into Tony Cade's paper.
So you're saying you're one of these Janetta Cole people?
I mean... I'm a graduate of Mount Holyoke College, but I did teach at Spelman for 1 year, and it was a really wonderful experience. So I was, you know, happy to be able to hop over there. But yeah, the stuff is not necessarily digitized in the ways that, like, some of Octavia's work is digitized at the Huntington, or at all the works of the Schoenberg, or so on, because it's Holly.
Right. How okay, we're gonna take a little break. This has been wonderful. I'm talking this morning to Susanna M. Morris. She is a professor of literature, media, and communication at Georgia Institute of Technology. We're talking about her new book, Positive Obsession: The Life and Times of Octavia E. Butler. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
This is your social justice calendar for the week of October 27th, 2025. On Sunday, November 2nd, Haile, Jerima, and Sankofa Video Books and Cafe present Congo on Our Mind from 7 to 9 p.m., where artists and performers are committed to liberation and justice for genocide globally. It is located on 2714 Georgia Avenue Northwest, and for more info and to RSVP, visit sankofa.com. Also on Sunday, November 2nd, from 5 to 8 p.m., there will be a Love Sound Benefit Concert for the Congo and WPFW, located on Westminster Presbyterian Church, 400 I Street Southwest, Washington, D.C. Doors open at 4:30 p.m. For more info, visit eventbrite.com or WPFWDC on Instagram. WPFW's social justice calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's social justice calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Susanna Morris, and we're talking about her book, Possessed: Positive Obsession, The Life and Times of Octavia E. Butler. Susanna, you have an Octavia E. Butler chronology at the beginning of your book, and I would like you to comment on three things that happened to her. Sure. One, 1969, her meeting Harlan Ellison. Two, 1970, attended the Summer Clarion Science Fiction Workshop. And three, 1995, when she received the MacArthur Foundation Award. Just take us through those three highlights of her life.
So meeting Harlan Ellison was really pivotal for her. He became a really important cheerleader in her life and mentor, someone who helped shape her writing. She had you know, in high school and in college. She went to Pasadena City College, which is a junior college in Southern California. She was encountering folks who did not know what to do with her work as a science fiction writer, did not know what to do with her work just as a Black woman who would coming in, you know, writing quote unquote strange fiction, and folks would accuse her of plagiarizing things. You know, you couldn't have possibly written this.
Sounds like August Wilson.
Right. Or very much, this is weird and strange and I don't understand this. Can you write something normal, basically? And so Harlan Ellison, you know, had already had a storied career as a writer and an editor. He was a volatile person. He was sort of hard to work with. Yeah. They had, you know, an up and down relationship in terms of being mentor, mentee, and also mm-hmm. friends. But she really credits him as being significant in her life. And likewise, when she was able to go to the Clarion Writers Workshop in 1970, she worked with Ellison again. She met Samuel Delaney and other folks. She met folks like Vonda McIntyre, who would become a really good friend over the years. And she found that to really be the incubator for her work, right? She did not get a bachelor's degree. She got an associate's in history, which she used very well, right? Mm-hmm. It was the Clarion Writers Workshop that really helped to catalyze her career as a writer. Not so much in terms of getting a bunch of things published. She published two short stories from that time, and then there was a 5-year drought in terms of getting anything published. She was writing.
When you go back, and this goes into connect to what we were talking about her papers, do you see people commenting on the work that she had at that time that she was workshopping?
I didn't so much focus on that, but I was really focusing on how she felt about the experience.
I see.
And so she felt like she was being put through the ringer. It was so difficult. She called herself a slow writer. And so she's constantly, you know, for the weeks that she's there, you know, having to produce all of this work and getting critiques and having to read other people's work. It was just like a boot camp.
Mm. Well, let me ask you this, because you were talking about this. If you look at what's happening, people that she's meeting, like Ellison and also Delaney, is there a body of correspondence that she writes letters back and forth to those individuals?
To Ellison, for sure. She mm-hmm. wasn't as close with Samuel Delaney. They were more colleagues as the years went on. But during that time period, she did take a course with him. Mm-hmm. But they didn't develop like a close friendship at
correspondence
that
type of thing.
No. And then in 1995, she wins the MacArthur, mm-hmm. and it is $295,000 of unrestricted funds paid out over the course of 5 years. And, you know, finances had been an issue for her. Anybody who knows a working writer, you don't write because you think you're going to get rich. You write because you love the art, right? And so that really shifted her life, because money had been such a huge concern. It remained a concern even when she had money, right? She couldn't kind of shake the worry that she had lived with for all of her life.
But what about the other thing that comes with the MacArthur, that's quote, the Genius Award? Did that affect her?
So there's a lovely interview that she has with Charlie Rose. Folks can watch it on YouTube. And he's like, the Genius Award. And she just is like, Charlie, that's not what it's called. You know, she was a fairly humble person. It's called this. It's, you know, I'm not calling myself a genius. That's a bit much. You know, she was clearly a genius, but she wasn't inviting people to call her that. But you know, it's the thing about the MacArthur is that you cannot apply for it. It is something that folks have to recommend you for, and you don't necessarily get it the first time you're recommended, right? And those of us who've written recommendation letters for folks for MacArthur's, you know that you might write a letter for somebody and they not get a MacArthur until 5 years later. And they just put your little letter on file and then they add to it and then they look at what the scope of this person's work is, right? It's really significant that she's the first science fiction writer to win a MacArthur, not the first woman science fiction writer, first science fiction writer, period, to win it. So that also opened up the field in a particular kind of way.
You write in your book, Susanna Morris, that you considered Butler one of the foremost intellectuals of the 20th century. That's a big statement there. I'm going to put you on the stand. When we look at her books, what are the major issues that she's examining, and why do you elevate her to this important as an intellectual thinker?
Mm-hmm. I think that there's so many themes that are significant, but one that I would focus on for today is, especially in light of all the news that we're hearing about a hopeful ceasefire, right, for, you know, Palestinians, is this idea of the human contradiction. It's a term that she comes up with in the Xenogenesis trilogy, also known as Lilith's Brood. And in it, the Oankali, the aliens that come and sort of see human beings like, y'all are destructive as hell. Why should you be able to live on your own? Clearly you need, you know, to be on a leash in some ways. They note that human beings have a contradictory impulse, that we're extremely intelligent and we're resourceful and we're very hierarchical. And that this idea of hierarchy is oftentimes at service, or rather our intelligence is in service to this idea of hierarchy, but the hierarchies that we create don't make sense. They're arbitrary, right? I live here, you live there, you speak this language, you look like this, you worship this God, I don't like you, you're inferior to me. And we create whole social systems based on these very arbitrary things that actually don't matter. They're not evidence of our morality or character or ability or anything like that. And that we therefore are a self-destructive adolescent species. And I think that notion, even though it's articulated in that very specific kind of way in that series, shows up in almost every book. So we're really smart, but we're stupid at the same time, because why are we focusing on these things that don't really matter? We can create any kind of world we want to, but we've created this world. It doesn't have to be this
world. When we look at this world, I was just curious as to how much reading and studying did Octavia Butler have in terms of when we look at socialism and Marxism, because some of her work does seem to be a critique of capitalism. I'm just wondering whether she was grounding herself in Marxist theory.
I don't know that she would say grounding herself in Marxist theory, but she was familiar with it. She read about it. I don't know that she would call herself anti-capitalist per se, but she had critiques of capitalism for sure, identified as a Black feminist thinker. There's an interesting moment. I don't really write much about it, but I think about it sometimes, where I think I just mentioned she goes to see Angela Davis at a lecture. And so, early 1980s, she goes to see Angela Davis, and she's talking about, you know, capitalism and so on. And in, you know, her notes, she's writing down what Professor Davis is saying, and she's also critiquing. She's like, well, actually, I think that her notion of capitalism here is not quite, and I think it does this and so on. So she was someone that it was hard for her to be like, I fall into this camp, because she had critiques of everything. So, for example, with Black Power, she was like, yep, I absolutely. This sounds good. And also the massage noir of it all. I can't get behind that, or, you know, these kinds of things. So she was never like just one thing. So she had huge critiques of capitalism, but she was like, oh, these are the benefits of it in some ways too. Right. So.
Let's look at this closely, this label of Black feminist, because if we look at, we know that became problematic at a particular period in time. And I think when we look at it, you could probably say, okay, here's Barbara Smith, here's Audre Lorde, here's June Jordan. There's different interpretations of feminists. How would you find where you would place Octavia Butler? Was she one of the, you know, I'm looking at her in relation to, say, Toni Capron Barrett, other people, Fran Beal or someone like that. Where does she appear within Black feminist thought?
Yeah, I mean, she is in conversation. These are her peers, right? And Toni Capron is a friend, right? The ultimate cultural worker.
Right. What about bell hooks? Did she interact with bell hooks?
They knew of each other, but they were not close friends or anything like that. But Octavia was familiar with all the folks, the Alice Walker and the womenism. She did a review of In Search of Our Mother's Gardens for the Washington Post. Like, she was very much in dialogue with folks. And again, identified as a feminist when it was not cool. I don't know that it's ever cool to identify as a feminist. But so she was very much in, again, this idea of arbitrary hierarchy, right? She did not believe in gender essentialism. She was not anti-Black man, right? She was not anti-anybody. But this idea that women are inferior because of sex or gender, when these are social constructs, was a thing that she found irksome. Right.
Well, let's talk to you. Let's focus on you, Susanna Mars, because you define yourself as a Black feminist. How has it changed in terms of, you know, I mean, this is 2025. This is not like 1975. So what have you seen an increase in terms of certain issues that are being addressed? Are there books that have come up that say provide a more clear direction of what Black feminism is?
There's tons of stuff. The thing is,
I like how you say there's tons of stuff.
There's tons of stuff. You know, and obviously I'm biased because I'm in the community. But I'm thinking about works by, there's so many examples. So an example from the past, right? Recent past, I would say, you know, the Words of Fire, Beverly Guy Sheftall. Beverly Guy Sheftall, as a mentor to so many of us, in the Black feminist communities, you know, the Bell Hooks Institute, there's so many examples. And then there, you know, those of us from my generation, the sort of Gen X, elder millennials, you know, I'm a part of the Krunk Feminist Collective, and we fashioned ourselves after the Combahee River Collective. So we've been around for 15 years.
What African-American male intellectuals you would consider Black feminists?
This is the thing. I don't think that most of the men that call themselves, most of the men that move in feminist ways don't always call themselves feminists, right? And I'm not super interested in labels. It's my label.
Right.
But are you doing the work? So I would say like a Mark Lamont Hill, right? And his work, and especially the way that he writes very academic work. You know, he's a professor, but he's also on like podcasts with Joe Budden and just doing regular stuff, right? And inserting himself, you know, being like, you know, on VH1 with the Basketball Wives and talking about stuff. Like, he's very much ecumenical and always kind of able to speak to like in lots of different registers and so on.
You really asked that question. Really asked that question is because I was looking at how you can measure the impact of a revolutionary movement on the people who might have been opposed to it. And I know that when we talked about, you know, going back to Black feminists, people were against it and men were going. And so I was looking at the growth of, you know, these intellectual Black men. Yeah, I like how you say
This is an ongoing issue, the manosphere,
right.
You know, like there, the issues around gender in Black communities is still very fraught in many ways. We're still living in the aftermath of the Moynihan Report,
right?
And not just Black men, Black women might be moving in feminist ways or having, you know, feminist ideologies in their lives, but they don't necessarily want to use the term, which again, I don't have a problem with. Womanist, feminist, nothingist, whatever you want to call yourself. But there's still this concern, like, our brother's going to be okay if I believe in this thing. And I'm like, that's the least.
Well, let me ask you this. When I raise these points, to me, it's like, okay, this is what's going on in the community. But what about you who you're in the academy? You know, do you see a struggle in terms of what you have to teach? We're going through a period right now in terms of the last eight, nine months that people, if you have a certain word or whatever, you can't teach that. I mean, and you're in the South.
I am. Yeah, I mean, I see it happening all across the country. I have been very blessed to be supported in my program. But the general tone and tenor is that, you know, folks have been on watch lists. Folks have been identified as dangerous or as doing work that is literally illegal. You know, just a few years ago, there was a whole crop of folks doing DEI-focused programming and so on, not necessarily academics, but folks who work at academic institutions, and those jobs have been eliminated or absorbed and so on. So it's a really harrowing time to be working at a college or university.
Have any of Octavia Butler's books showed up on the censorship list? And if so, for why?
Explicit violence, sex, all those things. Kindred, I mean, pretty much every book, right? These are books that have graphic depictions of violence, of sex. Fledgling has like very strange age gap stuff happening. I mean, but really, honestly, the banning is because she's talking about race and gender in really provocative ways. And there is this, you know, idea that we need to shield children from these things while we live in a world that is racist and sexist. And all,
let's go back to what you said, and you were introduced to actually, but when you're in high school, and that's a key point. What if, for example, those books by October Button were not available to you at that particular time? Would you, I mean, look at how did that book change your life?
Well, I had not been reading books by Black folk in school. I was a voracious reader, and I read many books by Black people on my own, right? Encouraged by my mother, like, go to the library every week.
But that's a good point. But what if the librarian is all of a sudden the books they can't put on the shelf?
That's the thing. And I'm from Florida, where some of the worst book banning is coming from, right? And so I just think about the fact that I graduated from high school in 1998, and somebody who's graduating in 2026 has less access to what I had almost 30 years ago. That's wild. You know, we have this notion of progress and it's forever going forward, but we know if we look at history that it's not that simple, right? And we're at a time of deep regression.
Sounds like we need another reconstruction.
When that works.
You know, you claim, Susanna Morris, in your book, that Octavia Butler cleared a path for literary revolution. What did you mean by that?
Yes. So the ways that she sort of opened up the field of science fiction and fantasy, right, that was for many years just her, Samuel R. Delaney, and Stephen Barnes, right? And so along with them, she cleared this pathway, the fact that she's connecting with her fellow Black woman writers, you know, like your Alice Walkers and your Toni Morrisons and your Toni Cades and all of that. She is a part of this path clearing, but she did it in her own unique way. She is the first that we know of Black woman to primarily publish in science fiction and fantasy. And she's the only one we know who's done that, who she was Black from the beginning. There's no like, oh, we don't know. I mean, her picture wasn't always on the books. And sometimes they put white folk on the covers where it did not make sense. Dawn is a great example of that, or Pattern Master. But, you know, she was always who she was. Her picture was in the newspaper. She went to cons. She's like, here I am. I'm Black. I'm writing these things. And she was a possibility model, even though that was never necessarily her intention. She was like, I have to do this. This is my obsession. So that's what I mean about her clearing that path.
You know, as we move towards the end of our show, I want you to talk about two books and sort of invite our listeners into Octavia Butler's world. You write in a book about how Kindred, which came out in 1979, is usually a reader's gateway into Octavia's work. So I wanted you to talk about that a little more and why it is a gateway. If, for example, I never heard of Octavia Butler, I'm listening to you today, what should I expect in terms of that book? And then the other one I want you to talk about, which gets a lot of reference to, is Parable of the Sower in 1993.
Yeah. So, Kindred is a fantasy. She called it a grim fantasy because there's no science in it. Mm-hmm. And for folks who are intimidated by speculative fiction, by science fiction, fantasy, horror, etc., it is a good gateway because there's no like, this is how the time machine works. And this is, you know, sometimes that is off-putting to a reader. It's hard for them to suspend their disbelief. They're too caught up in the mechanisms. And that's not what that book is about. That book is about getting folks to feel what it would be like to be an enslaved person and how terrifying that would have been, right? And how strong those people were. That's really there are many points to it, but that's one of the main things that she wants us to feel. That's not dissimilar from reading Margaret Walker's Jubilee or Toni Morrison's Beloved. You're going to get into the interior life of these folks and what they experience. So it's not simply about the spectacular violence. It's like, what does it mean to get up every day and not own your body? Mm-hmm. And to have these curious relationships with the other enslaved people, with the white folk, with the land. What does that mean? So it is a historical novel. If you took out the time travel elements, it would just be a really wonderful historical novel. So that connects with people. It's sort of like palatable in that way, even though it's a very hard novel to read because it's about slavery.
Well, let me mention something for our listeners, because you mentioned this in your book, Positive Obsession. Octavia Butler does a lot of that research coming to Maryland and D.C., you know, because of Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass. So people in this area, our listeners, should really get into this book because this is the landscape that she was using.
Yeah, and she didn't just like use her imagination. She did that, but she spent a lot of time in the library in Los Angeles. She had her own collection of books that she looked at. She talked with people in her family who were around in the late 19th century, early 20th century. So after slavery, but folks who would have had like, oh, my grandmother was an enslaved person, that kind of thing. And then she literally went to archives. So it's very historically grounded. It just has this one speculative element in that there's time travel, right?
Okay. And so, as we go, we're running out of time. Talk about Parable of the Sower.
Yes. With Parable of the Sower, it's set in 2024. July 20th, 2024 is when it opens. It's an epistolary novel, so it's a bunch of diary entries. And so, again, it's not a novel. It's of the near future because it was published in 1993. The things that happen in that novel are, unfortunately, the things that are happening now. But when they were published, they were things that could happen. It was a cautionary tale. So we could have a white nationalist president. We could have a fascist regime. We could have wildfires ravaging the nation. We could have dirty water and unclean air and all these kinds of things. And how would a young person navigate living, growing up, you know, a Gen Zer, how would they navigate that? Well, maybe they create their own religion so that they can figure out how to move through this world that is so different from what their parents experience. So again, if you're someone who struggles with the suspension of disbelief, we in it. It's almost depressing. So,
and you know, I want to make reference in terms of we come to the end of our program in Dark Matter, Sheree Thomas's book. The last entry is by Octavia Butler, the monophone on response. And she writes about perhaps someday we will have truly alien company. Perhaps we will eventually communicate with other life elsewhere in the universe, or at least become aware of other life, distant but real, existing with or without our belief, with or without our permission. Let me ask you, I mean, I tell people I'm waiting for the great pumpkin, you know, this month. Do you believe that in terms of looking at Octavia Butler's work, that there are things that will be coming to us, you know? And because I look at, there's a book that I read, the same way you were dealing with Octavia Butler. I read Profiles of the Future by Arthur C. Clarke. Mm-hmm. And he had this little pull-out thing in the back. It was like, I had this in 65. And right around like 2025, it says like extraterrestrial connection, you know, that we'd be seeing there. And so I'm waiting for that. So are there anything that you're waiting for?
I'm interested to see, are we going to be encountering? I mean, I'm really waiting for human beings to grow up. That's what I'm waiting for. As a child of the millennium, where's my flying car?
Okay, I know one American who should grow up, but I won't mention any names. Okay. Well, Susanna Morris, I want to thank you for being my guest on the March. It's been a wonderful conversation. My guest today has been Susanna Morris. She's Associate Professor of Literature, Media, and Communication at Georgia Institute of Technology. And we've been talking about her fantastic new book, Positive Obsession, The Life and Times of Octavia E. Butler. The show's On the Margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
WPFW comes in part from Friends of the Congo, a 501c3 entity that will be hosting Love Sound, an evening of soul sisters in support of WPFW and Friends of the Congo's DRC Women, Peace, and Security Center in Kinshasa. This event will be Sunday, November 2nd from 5 to 8 p.m. at Westminster Presbyterian Church, 400 I Street, Southwest. Performers include Navasha Dea, Liani Mataka, Janelle Gill, Sweet Sweet Honey in the Rock, and more. More information on this event is available at WPFWFM.org.
The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations calls on all those who are demanding an end to the wars, genocide, and escalation of brutal state repression. On Saturday, November 1st, Malcolm X Park in D.C., 11 o'clock a.m., we are holding our annual Black People's March on the White House to deliver a strong message to Trump, DOGE, Project 2025, ICE, Democrats, Republicans, and all colonizers, with the message that we are not afraid and we will not be silenced. As serious as these times are, organizing, not agonizing, is our message. This is our time, and we must not hesitate to seize it. Details at www.blackisbackcoalition.org. That's blackisbackcoalition.org.
The soul of West Africa lands at Brentwood Arts Exchange's Listening Room on Friday, November 7th at 8 p.m. with Cheikh Amala Jabate, a master of the Ngori, the traditional West African lute. Jabate weaves stories through rhythm and song, blending ancient sounds with a modern spirit that moves both heart and feet. Details at pgparks.com. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
This is Rev Yearwood, and I am so excited to announce our new climate show, Think 100% Climate Friday. This show will keep you up to date on everything climate justice related in a rapidly changing world. We will discuss breaking news and updates on environmental issues, the climate crisis, COVID-19, and politics. This show will make tangible how the climate crisis is already impacting our lives and what you can do about it. So tune in every Friday at 9 o'clock a.m. right here on WPFW 89.3, your jazz and justice station.
The place to be in Washington, D.C. on Saturday, November 1st, 5 to 8 p.m. is the Paul Robeson Peace and Justice Awards Gala. Named in the honor of the champion of civil rights, the event honors Josh Williams with keynote speaker Tom Porter. The evening includes dinner and entertainment by Free Benjamin, Veronica Fashion, the Warrior Drumline, Youth Group, and Wata. At the Festival Center, 1640 Columbia Road, Northwest, and is presented by the D.C. Friends of the People's World and the Claudia Jones School of Political Education. Details, 202-977-1407. Once again, details at 202-977-1407. We'll see you there.
D'Angelo is loved not only for his own music, but also for being one of the chief architects of neo-soul. His 1995 album, Brown Sugar, helped to define what neo-soul would become. On Saturday, November 1st, 7 a.m. until midnight, WPFW presents Brown Sugar, the genius of D'Angelo and the explosion of neo-soul, celebrating his unique style and innovative approach to Black music, as well as neo-soul, a sound both retro and futuristic. Programmers James Funk and Captain Fly, DJ Lance Reynolds, Jasonic, The Culture Shack, and Soul Conversations Crews, and Decipher's Ill Street Grooves come together in this special day of fundraising to explore D'Angelo's music, artists that influenced him and the genre, and the global neo-soul landscape that defined a generation. That's Brown Sugar, the genius of D'Angelo and the explosion of neo-soul. November 1st on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Sunline Youth Group, and WATA, held at the Festival Center, 1640 Columbia Road Northwest, and is presented by the D.C. Friends of the People's World and the Claudia Jones School of Political Education. Details 202-977-1407. Once again, details at 202-977-1407. We'll see you there.
D'Angelo is loved not only for his own music, but also for being one of the chief architects of Neo Soul. His 1995 album, Brown Sugar, helped to define what Neo Soul would become. On Saturday, November 1st, 7 a.m. until midnight, WPFW presents Brown Sugar, the genius of D'Angelo and the explosion of Neo Soul, celebrating his unique style and innovative approach to black music, as well as Neo Soul, a sound both retro and futuristic. Programmers James Funk and Captain Fly, DJ Lance Reynolds, Jasonic, The Culture Shack, and Soul Conversations Crews, and Decipher's Ill Street Grooves, come together in this special day of fundraising to explore D'Angelo's music, artists that influenced him and the genre, and the global Neo Soul landscape that defined a generation. That's Brown Sugar, the genius of D'Angelo and the explosion of Neo Soul. November 1st on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.